real experts in different areas that can talk on the same topic. So I want to introduce all three of the panelists. We got Dr. Larry Lauer here, mental skills extraordinaire. His background is phenomenal. He worked for many, many years at Michigan State University in the Institute of Youth Sport. He's got a strong background in hockey as well. If any of you are hockey fans?
Ice hockey.
Yes, ice hockey. Cloud hockey. And for the last few years, he's been heading up the mental skills program at the U.S. Tennis Association. But he has vast experience both as a PhD in sports psychology and in the academic world. But he works every day in shorts and a t-shirt and works with players on court. So it's a great perspective. And having that mental skills person as part of your team is so important, and how to integrate that is really some of the stuff that he's going to share. Ollie Stevens, a phenomenal tennis coach by background, from the UK originally, been living in the US for a number of years. But he really is one of these tennis coaches across the globe. He's got a very strong background in fitness training and physical training. But I would probably he would probably classify himself as a coach first, physical trainer second. But he has the experience and the knowledge to do both. So it's great to have someone that works in the trenches, works in an academy setting with junior development players, and having that perspective is really beneficial. And then Dr. Jeff Chandler, many of you in the strength and conditioning world, he doesn't need any introduction. He's been the editor-in-chief of the Strength and Conditioning Journal for decades, and he knows everything that comes out in the world of strength and conditioning. It comes across his desk about 6 months before any of us ever see it. So it's great to have his experience and knowledge base here and to talk about how to link that strength and conditioning component as part of the team. So it was a real honor for me just to moderate this session. My job is to, you know, make sure that you get your questions answered. We really don't have a plan for this. The beauty of our panels is you get to ask the questions you want. You know, one of the things I'm most interested in is with many of the people in here, they work in team environments. We see a lot of, you know, college strength coaches, in the room. And one of the challenges is how do you fit all your areas of specialty alongside the tennis coach's skill set, who's on court 20 plus hours a week trying to develop a player. So I may open that up to Dr. Lauer to start with, just from a mental skills perspective and working with teams and also in hockey, maybe using some of that experience, how do you see that cohesiveness of the different specialties working together?
I think it starts with the team perspective that you're going to work together, that there's a mission that everybody's aligned around. You have goals that you're trying to achieve. I know for when I was at USA Hockey's national team in Ann Arbor, the goals were set, and each of us played our role to achieve those goals, so it was very clear in that team setting. A lot of what I try to do in that setting, in that environment, was I'd come down for the day, and I would spend the day there, and I would watch practice. I would talk with the coaches, I would talk with the strength staff, I would talk with the equipment manager, and anyone that I could talk to, see what was going on with the players. I would sit in scouting meetings, I would run my own meetings, I would do individual meetings, I would meet with the coaching staff and debrief them on what we're going to do. And so just trying to really integrate what you're doing into the system that exists. So instead of me coming in and saying, well, I think we should work on reducing their anxiety, if the coaching staff is seeing that the biggest issue they have is motivation and practice, then let's all kind of work first together on what the biggest need is and then go from there. So I think it's integrating into the system, communicating with everybody else. At player development, it's a little different animal because the way I look at it and the way I've tried to, and Martin spoke to this, conceptualize it, is that we work as a team around a player. And the team is the players at the center of the universe, which we don't tell them that, but you're at the center, and then the coach facilitates the whole thing, and then the support staff is around the player, all working together to figure out how do we move this player forward. And through our communication and meeting, Martin talked about having quarterly meetings. Those are just sort of checkpoints to make sure that we're making progress. Through that way, I think that enhanced communication and working together, we start to see things move faster. But I think one key point is that you got to be very clear and aligned on what the goals are. Again, because if I feel one thing and Brett Waltz, who you meet, is thinking something else, and we're going different routes, then that's really not beneficial to the player. So we do try to communicate, get on the same page. In that sense, I think it's helpful. And then the coaches and the players hear what I'm trying to do, how it fits within everything that they do, versus Martin said how it used to be done 20 years ago. It was a rainy day, so you go and we're going to do a sports psych session. I already lay down, do some visualization. That's a great way to train how to visualize, but how do you bring it to the court? How do you bring it to daily training? And that's what we try to do through these meetings and being very practical and very specific to what that player needs in their developmental plan. So I don't know if that...
Ollie, anything from your perspective as being sort of on the coaching side and being around a lot of these different expertise, how do you implement it into your program?
Yeah, it's a couple of things strike me is that... There's a lot more education available these days than there used to be as a coach, and I come at you from a, you know, like Mark said, I consider myself, I'm a tennis coach first before anything else, and I'm on court, man, I wish I was on court 20 hours a week, it's more like 50, we've got to make sure that everything is planned for a start. Planning is huge, and that's something that I've kind of been educated on myself in the last several years, is making sure that there's a plan. And we have a system in place, but just because the coach or the academy has a system, that's not the set way of doing it. Because you know we have what's called athlete-centered coaching, and every athlete is different. And we've also got to be very aware of the age and the ability level of the student that we're working with, the athlete. So, for example, we can have a 16. I was just actually telling Jeff that I have a 14-year-old girl I teach who's 6'3". You know, and mentally she's 12. She's very young, so I'll talk to her like she's 18 years old, and I just won't get anywhere. And that's where I just have to make sure that, you know, physically but also mentally I'm working with her specific needs and not what I think a 6'3" athlete should work with, you know, because I consider, you know, you talk to her and it's like you think you're talking to a woman, you're not, you're talking to a little girl because she's so tall. So it's making sure that we keep in mind that we have a system and we have a support system of sports psychiatrists and of PTs and of experts in that field. But at the same time, just because that's our system, we shouldn't say that that's the only way we're going to do it. We have to have this ability to improvise and to alter things. And it could be day by day, let alone, you know, and you know, as anyone knows who works with children or even with adults, that they'll come to you on Monday and then they'll come to you on Tuesday and it's these two completely different people, you know, and they might have not had a good night's sleep or something might be going on at home or their diet might be off or, you know, something hormonal might be going on, and you have to make sure that we have this ability to adapt and kind of think on our feet while still keeping our core principles in place.
Any questions from the floor?
Speak to your role with the injured athlete?
That's a great question. What my role is to support what Brett or the staff is trying to help that player. I'm sorry?
Maybe explain your brain.
Brett is in charge of athletic training. My apologies. He's going to be here tomorrow. So I'm going to be involved more on obviously on the psychological side to talk with Brett about what's going on. Aside from the player, so at least I have some backdrop on what the ramifications could be psychologically. If we're talking about a long-term serious injury and a lot of rehab, then I'm thinking in one way, if it's just a quick, you know, I'm out a week or two, maybe it's just more trying to keep their mind sharp and keeping them focused on what they need to do in their routines away from the court. So I try to figure out what it is that this person's going to go through, anticipate maybe how they might respond, and also take into account their history. Have they gone through something similar before, or is this the first time, and try to account for those things. And then really what matters is just giving some time to at least see where they're at. Because they may be doing fine, you know, maybe 5-10 minutes, and you figure out, you know, this person's okay. And so then you let them go about their business. If I've got more concerns, we're going to go ahead and set up a plan. But for most of our players who are going to be out for a while, we're going to set up at least some kind of plan to help them first deal with the fact that they're out and that they're injured, and eventually moving towards to commitment to the rehab, and then finally, how are they going to handle the return to play and coming back. And one of the things we always talk about is that as patience is a word that always comes up, is being patient with yourself and yet being very aware of your body. and trusting. You know, so if your docs are telling you that it's strong and it can hold up, then you need to trust that, and you need to go ahead and give it a run. So it's certainly a case by case, where every case is different, but we do try to do our best to any athlete that's injured to take a look at that and decide, is there something specific that we need to do? So.
Do you have any kind of tips or suggestions on how, although we talked about a little bit earlier, there's the time issue, and you have, you know, some kids who are homeschooled and they have a lot more time, some who are in school until 2 o'clock. I find it difficult to get all of the components in for the players that they, and there's obviously a lot of overlap, but just kind of in general, how all of you work together if there's time constraints.
Yeah, for me, it comes down to planning. You know, if I see an athlete, and they can still be a very good tennis player and train 10 hours a week, you've got to make sure that those 10 hours are very fruitful. And if you just kind of, and all the coaches in here, you know, you guys are the best coaches in the industry, you know this, if you kind of walk on the court with the kid and you kind of go, well, let's start off by hitting some cross courts and, you know, we'll kind of see how it goes, then it's a waste of time. But if you go on, then you have a set plan, albeit adaptable, then that I find we can actually start to fit everything in. Now, is it a perfect scenario to have, you know, that amount of time? No, but can you make it work? Yeah, absolutely. And then utilize the weekends when there are no tournaments and early morning stuff and things like that. And also making sure that their general athletic skills develop. You know, when they're at school, you know, my best tennis player in Chicago where I worked with was a pretty highly ranked national junior. I'm convinced the reason she was so is because she played soccer and basketball at school. I'm absolutely convinced of that, and that really helped her tennis development a lot. So things like, you know, she said to me, shall I do soccer or shall I be on the swim team? I was like, soccer, strength, maybe. Soccer, and that really helped her tennis skill set.
Can I just, Marianne, if you don't mind, in speaking to, like, you know, making better use of our time or integration, so at least I can speak to the mental side, but if we're working on the player to be more calm and composed under pressure, when they're doing match play, so this is already in the schedule, this isn't adding anything, I'll come down to the court and I'll watch their routines and see if we're sticking to the routines. The coach will know what we're trying to do. So we can be giving feedback on that kind of things, on that side of things, while they're performing. So that we may not need another meeting or to add anything to their schedule, but we try to get the most from what's in the schedule. Now, certainly there are times where, obviously, I got to prepare them for that situation and I have to teach those things. But once that basis is there, then we can be very efficient by really working into the schedule that's already in place. Or, you know, talking with our strength staff, Satoshi, Gabriel, Rocket, you know, when we're doing training, how's the focus? How's the recovery? Are they doing their deep breathing that learn? So any way that we can integrate into what they're already doing, they internalize and learn it better, and they learn how to use the skills, but also we're maximizing the time that we have. So.
Go ahead.
Talk maybe just a little bit more, I guess, in that vein about the mental work and also the strength side of things. I'm a college status coach. I'm just curious, you know, routines come into play, like with the, you know, with the, my kids have about an hour and 15 minutes or so on a day. I'm not seeing the training day. I don't know how much that integrates in with your level.
Sure. I'm sorry, what's the question?
Just, and then maybe you were just mentioning, like, routines and mental focus, tennis court. How does that work on the strength side of things?
Sure, and what I will say is our staff does a great job, so there's not a lot that I need to be doing in that sense when they're in the training room, when they're actually working out. But what I will say is it's the same, for me, it's the same thing. It's engagement. Are you engaged in what you're doing in that moment and using the skills that they've learned to be in the moment? So if you go into the room and you're distracted, you're thinking about social media or what you're doing for dinner that night or whatever, you know how to get your focus back, and the strength coaches, fitness coaches know that as well. So they're expecting that of them. So we try to talk about all these things that we're teaching in different domains, whether it's school. You know, okay, so you're tired. It's 6 o'clock. You just had dinner. You would love to just sit down and watch TV for 3 hours, right, and just kind of veg out. But you've got it. You have to do your schoolwork. So how are you going to engage yourself? What have you learned about the process of engaging yourself that you can use before you go ahead to do your schoolwork or do your studies? So I think we try to take the skills that we're teaching and apply them in different situations. And then we can always do a better job with this, but then us as the adults around the players, understanding what we're trying to do and making them accountable in a positive way. Like, look, you know how to engage yourself in the court. How do you do that here in the weight room? Obviously, you're distracted. How do you get your focus? What should your mind be on right now? So I think it's the same process, just in a different domain and different ways. So
in terms of I woke up hoarse this morning. If you have trouble hearing, the Mark said he's got a microphone, but I'll try and speak up. In terms of strength and conditioning, I think it's about organization. Things have to be highly organized. You have to use every minute that's available to you in that hour and 15 minutes. And at the same time, it's about flexibility. If things happen that are unexpected, there's no courts available, or it's a rainy day, or for some reason the schedule changes, you have to be able to adapt. If you're in a tournament, an athlete loses, not as punishment, but as soon as you can, I mean, not within hours, but the next day, if you can get them an extra workout in as soon as possible, because they're not playing and other players on the team are playing, not as punishment, but to give them an opportunity to get better frame it in that context, so you make sure that they understand they're not being punished, that they're an opportunity to work harder.
Now you're creating a culture of, right, of getting better and learning versus outcome, which was spoken about in Martin's session. One of the things that we like to do, we can't always do it, is to. One of the things we like to do, we can't always do it, is to have the players win or lose go back out to the court for 15 minutes at a tournament. We can, because it just reinforces that it's not about the outcome; it's about the process. And so there's always things that we can work on after a match. And certainly, if you're out of the tournament, while we don't want that to happen, it's an opportunity to get better and grow in some other areas. So to Jeff's point, I think it's all about the way that we organize it and the way we talk about it. So, great point.
Question.
This is kind of a big topic, but since the concept here is team approach, I'm wondering how you each consider the idea of early specialization and overtraining.
I'll just tell you from a coach's point of view, obviously, we kind of set a benchmark that up until the age of 14 or 15, we want multiple sport athletes. But you see that early specialization when the kids are 9 or 10 and they show some kind of ability towards tennis, and a lot of the time the parents see dollar signs and they see college scholarships and they go, right, just tennis. And these kids get injured and they get burnt out very early on. And the sports that have the biggest crossover are soccer and basketball. So early specialization to me is a big no-no. I'm sure you guys probably have the same opinion.
I think there are some recent studies that do show that the athletes who do not specialize early, who participate in other sports up until the age of 15 or so, are better all-around athletes and do have more long-term success at tennis, and may even have a psychological component of how many years you play nothing but one sport.
I guess I just, supported everything that's being said up here, and then you have some kids who get sort of the atypical case who fall in love with the sport, and that's all that they want to do. And for me, it's always been about, it's got to come from the kid. It can't come from the parents. So if the kid is the one driving the bus, you keep them in multiple sports as long as you can, but they keep coming back, I want to do this, I want to do this. As long as it's done in a healthy way, You know, the more you can keep them in sports, and then I think for me, you know, specialization is a series of asking questions, I think. And the first question you have to ask is this something that the child wants, or is this something as a parent that I'm driving? And then go to coaches that you trust and people that you trust to get information. Like, is this the right decision to make? Are they ready? Are they ready physically? Are they ready emotionally, psychologically, socially? Hey, let's take that into account. Can this kid deal with the fact that maybe now they're going to have to homeschool, do online schooling, or do they want to stay in a public school? So I think there's a lot of things, questions that need to be asked of the right people, and understanding that there's a lot of agendas out there. There's a lot of reasons why people will tell you that you need to come and do this training, you know, because a lot of people are making a lot of money, and we're all part of that industry from young athletes. And I think ethically, we have to be very careful that we're making sure it's the right thing for the kid. Is it coming from the kid? Is it the right thing to do for them physically, mentally, emotionally, socially? There's a lot, for me, when it comes to specialization, a lot of questions that need to be answered. You know, I don't have the answer for anyone. You have to go and do your own research. So,
I think one of the things about specialization as well, as we're talking right now, about junior development, junior performance, you know, a lot of us here teach a lot of adults as well. I mean, wouldn't it be so cool if we're part of an adult's developmental plan, if you've got a 4-0, 35-year-old who wants to get to a 4-5 level, you can say, look, you know, go and join that social fireside soccer team or some of that, or, you know, work on, you know, go and join your YMCA basketball team and stuff, and that'll actually be part of your tennis development as well. So, you know, the general athletic skill base, you know, I think people think when you're 20 years old, you're done with your athletic development, and as everyone knows, for sure not.
Do you have an optimal time or, I should say, on-court training and off-court training as far as the number of hours that you're playing on court versus strength training versus mental training and everything else? Do you have somewhat of an optimal amount of time during a week or on a weekly basis?
Well, I think you follow the typical guidelines of frequency, intensity of resistance training. Try to do that 3 days a week, and then, you know, assuming you've got the athletes that I think the approach we're talking about is we've got them all week. Most of you do. So then you've got days when you're working more on footwork, speed, agility, coordination types of things. And, you know, I mean, it depends on the individual athlete, I think, to a large extent. But you have to train them. And, you know, I'm really not in, particularly in resistance training, into the training to failure idea, but they've got to do as high volume as they can comfortably do. And however long that takes in your situation, it may take, for 12-year-olds, it may take 25 minutes. For, for 16-year-olds, it may take an hour. So however long it takes to push them to their limit. Now, when you get into the speed and agility type stuff, you know, when they start getting fatigued and they start, that's when you start backing off, in my opinion. You don't want to push them. You've got to train them to fatigue and then a little past fatigue, but they're not going to get positive gains by continuing to be pushed after they pass that point of fatigue.
I think it's the same principle applies to on-court training as well, is that, you know, we have this closed skill training where someone's got to hit forehand after forehand after forehand, and also open skill training where we put that into a live ball situation and they play points. But there comes a point where you're just kind of beating a dead horse, and it's not getting any better, and you kind of ease off a little bit. So you've got to read the athlete. I'm a strong believer that if you want to improve your skills on, let's say, a forehand, you don't have to go and hit it for 6 hours. But if you hit for 45 minutes with quality and with a good intention and with a process goal and an outcome goal, then people will be more successful. But it's sometimes I see too much repetition. You know, someone will go out, and especially the parents, because it's cheaper to go and hit on a ball machine than it is to take a lesson. And they'll go around, and then they'll come to me and go, "Man, my kid here for 8 hours on the ball machine. I can't work out why their backhand's not getting any better." I'm like, because probably the last thing they were thinking about was backhand. They were just born out of their mind after a while. So you've got to make sure that, you know, they have a goal and it's achievable. You know, we talk about smarter goals. And then they'll show improvement, you know, one step at a time. I think not many people now here for kind of 8 hours a day anymore. But as far as on-court to off-court ratios, a perfect world for, you know, let's say a 15 or 16-year-old, I'd probably say about 50 or 60% of it on the court, and then 50 or 40% off court. So that's my personal opinion.
What I'll add to that is that I think what people missed, or what the media missed from the Erickson research that Martin mentioned, that deliberate practice involves quality engagement. It's not just putting the time in, it has to be quality time. I could do 10,000 hours of something and be 10,000 hours bad. I'm going to get better just because I'm there, but I'm not going to become great. And so the idea is quality engagement, whatever you're doing. And some kids can give you 2 hours, some kids can give you an hour and 15. You have to figure out what that is to do it at a level where they're continuing to get better. So that, to me, is very important. From a mental training standpoint, to answer your question, I'm pretty, pragmatic in the sense that if I'm working with a player, I like to have, generally speaking, one formal meeting a week. But it's pretty integrated, so if I'm at on court three times that week and we've had a chance to work on the mental side, that could be achieving the goals. So for me, tennis is 100% mental, 100% physical. And so I ask of our players to be constantly engaging their mind in different ways, whether it's problem solving, sticking to routines, preparing for practice, with great intention, knowing what their goal is for the day. I would rather teach them the skills that they're going to need to have high engagement and perform well in their environment than to bring them into mine and spend an hour once a week with no transfer. So I know it's not a very clear answer, but that's how I tend to do it. It's a little mixed methodology. Well, I would say there is a role for that. In some ways, I think it's getting overvalued too soon. Because when I look at the research, I'm not seeing we do this, we get this result, which is kind of an issue with mental training anyway. But if I'm going to spend $10,000 on some software, some equipment to do this, I'm still a big believer in the athletes having time to talk with someone that's not there judging their performance and pushing them in practice. They need that outlet, and the computer can't do that. So I think the human aspect of it, the humanistic aspect, I don't think it will ever replace that. I hope we don't. If we do, I'm getting out on the field, because to me it's about the relationships that are developed that helps people get the most out of themselves. Do I think there's a role for technology? Sure, whether it's using apps for them to monitor their own practice, whether it's mental training, physical training, using biofeedback. Biofeedback is a great method for helping athletes understand their own bodies, being able to lower their heart rate, adjust their breathing, use of heart monitors, different things. I think we definitely can use as tools to help us do our practice. It's something we're looking more and more into. I've been on this job for 2 years, and so it's right to this point, it's been more about establishing a system, what Martin alluded to, where we can really be effective in what we do, and now starting to add in some of the things that the technology that now, once the athletes and the coaches are bought into the system, I can say, okay, now let's go into this room and we're going to, put a video of the U.S. Open environment up, and I want you to visualize yourself performing in this environment. Now I could probably get them to do that. In my first year, they were looking at me, "Larry, what are you talking about? This doesn't have anything to do with me hitting the forehand." So I think we've tried to create a situation gradually over time where the athletes and the coaches really always did, but certainly the athletes now understand, like, this is a vital part of what we do. And so when I ask them something that's a little bit out in left field, they're like, okay, I'll do it. Because I believe in you, and you believe in me. So we're getting to that point now where I think we can bring in some other things that that we can use in the technology side as well.
Yeah, and I might just add, the last session of the conference, I'm going to be doing a future of tennis fitness, and we're going to be talking a lot about the technologies that are currently available, but also things that are coming down the pike. So we'll touch on that there.
And I'll go ahead and step on Mark's toes now and go
into it. Yeah, go into it.
I think take an electronic timing device, for example. You can put too much emphasis in that, and you can use it too often, so that the athlete thinks that, well, I'm a tenth of a second slower today, but there could be a lot of reasons for that. It could be how much sleep they've got, how hard they're studying. It could be that their parents are having issues, or they've got issues with their girlfriend. They've got life, and they've got all of the issues that we all have to deal with. So I think the technology is great as long as you don't overuse it and overemphasize it and say that, you know, something's wrong because this score was lower today than it was last week.
Questions for you. When you bring the team together, sometimes you want to inspire the players. You have toys and girls together. One thing I've seen, it's a boy that hit him well, and you really want him to feel good about it. You praise him, and it works. But sometimes with a girl, when you praise a girl, it's the worst thing you can do, because I'm looking, and they feel rejected from the other girls. Even you praise them, you see something good or something that's not good. It's always good with the girls. They can separately talk to them. When you feel like someone, say, for example, a girl didn't do well, and now you just want to put her in front of the group, it's always better to put it on the side, how you feel about it. They react totally different emotionally.
Yeah, I guess, you know, one thing we're kind of talking about is, you know, at least kind of what we know from research and theory is that, you know, guys with relationships, it's about establishing a pecking order and who's the alpha male. And there's a lot of competition and a lot of kind of smack talk. And we do a lot of that as guys, right? And that's sort of how we relate with one another, and we're more comfortable with that. Whereas with women, it tends to be much more about establishing relationships, where you're more on an even standpoint. And when a coach praises one woman over the others, it makes them feel like they're being kind of signaled out and separate from the group. And while we think it's a positive, because coming from our minds, it's like, geez, it's great when the coach points me out in front of my peers. But for them, it can be, not always, we're talking generalities here, that can be actually embarrassing or might have some relationship consequences. I think for either gender, I think it's better to pull them aside, look them in the eyes, and tell them what you think about them, because I think that shows you really care about them. And to me, that always has a lot of meaning when a coach will pull someone aside and take the time to have that personal moment. So I think that's always a great coaching technique. There will be times where you want to do that in front of the group, because maybe you want to send a message to the rest of the group. Maybe you're really trying to boost that kid's self-esteem in front of their peers. So yes, I think, it can be used. It just tends to work better with boys because of what I just mentioned. So I think it makes it tough for us as coaches, but then we have to be aware that the culture, the relationships that we're coaching and the peers that are on. Now, in tennis, in some ways, we have it easier than in team sports because, you know, we have a lot more one-on-one time, depending on how you're teaching. Some of you teaching pros may just work with groups, I don't know, but tennis affords us a lot of more one-on-one time, which is great, because you can do a little bit more of that personalization of what you're trying to do. So,
Jim?
Yeah, I know often there's a question. Fighting obesity, body fat percentage, things like that. Especially, I think, on the female side, we see a lot of pointing fingers out. This one's not fit, this one's not fit. But I think there's a mental side to it, too. And then the genetic side of when is it a health problem, and when is it a it's just a genetic issue, and they're actually quite fit. And I know there's some testing with it, but there's also a crossover on the mental side. We see it from time to time, like at a younger age especially. Do you guys identify it, and plan for it, and see that coming?
Yeah, that's a difficult one, because you know, you've got to be really careful as a coach in how you talk to your athletes about body type and things like that. And I'll just give you a quick example. I lived in Chicago for 6 years, and I don't know whether this is a claim to fame or a claim to shame, but when she was in town, I was working off-court training with Taylor Townsend, and she received a lot of criticism because of her body type. And I'll tell you right now, I've never worked with a kid that worked harder off-court. It was unbelievable. She was doing sprints, and she was, fit, and she was hitting the gym, and she was, doing long distance stuff. And she'll always be a big girl, and that's just the way she is. And she's still a tremendous tennis player. And so there's no point in looking at an athlete like that and saying you've got to change your body type, because it ain't going to happen. She's just going to be, and then maybe as a coach you have to say, okay, I've got this particular body type of 5'5", 200-pound female athlete. And what's the game style going to be around that? We've got to maybe, and that's where again, it comes back to athlete-centered coaching. Now, from a mental standpoint, I refer to the experts, and there's obviously some things that could be done. And, but it's a really tough one. You've got to be careful with it, because you can probably say the wrong thing to someone, and then you can set off a whole different chain of events. It could lead to bulimia and things like that. So it's difficult.
I agree. You do have to be very careful with that. However, I will say that beyond a certain point, carrying excess body fat is going to be detrimental to performance. I just think you have to be very, very careful in how that's handled with particularly with female athletes, particularly with male coaches of female athletes. And even excess muscle mass, for a while, I think a lot of people got the idea that we were trying to build a lot of upper body muscle and big biceps and big triceps and deltoids and tennis players and things like that, and that's not the case either. I think the key there is building strength and power and speed without adding the muscle mass, because the weight of the weight of the arm is going to, whether it's fat or whether it's muscle, it's going to slow it down to some extent. And whole body, it's impossible to carry excess fat and not have it be detrimental to performance beyond a certain point. Exactly where that point is in terms of percent body fat, beyond a certain point, it's got to be detrimental.
I think one point that needs raising, just very briefly as well, we've touched on it over society, is that in the industry, and as tennis coaches, and I can't speak to PTs or physicians or anything like that, there's a real lack of female tennis coaches, and that's got to change. So I'm part of the professional tennis registry for those uninvolved in just tennis. That's our one of the certification bodies of tennis coaches too in this country. And 21% of our membership is female, which is terribly low. And we're trying to push that up to at least 33% in the next few years, all kinds of programs. So it's again, we need more female coaches because maybe they can relate better to a female athlete.
Can I just make one comment?
Sorry.
Okay. I would say just some advice for talking to the athletes when it comes to things like weight and the body. Found it's better to focus on controllable factors like speed, power, things of that nature. So how you talk about it is very important. If you talk about it from a performance standpoint, I think it is a much better way than to talk about trying to get to a certain weight or that kind of stuff. Now those are variables obviously that the staff are looking at and they want to get those down, but we try not to make a big deal of that and focus more on other things that the athlete sees as being athletic and things that truly that they need. So, I would change the conversation and focus more on those things it's certainly something that we tell our coaches, and I think our coaches are getting it, that they need to be careful with these. Because I just this week I heard two coaches say to me, "I know I got to be careful about what I say." I said, "Exactly. Here's where this conversation probably should go." So.
But, well, thanks, guys. That went really, really fast. I know we didn't get to everyone's questions. These guys are going to be around during lunch, so find them, ask your questions there. Now we're going to transition to the next session. We'll give you a couple minutes if you need to go to the restroom. In here, we're going to have the strength and conditioning program for collegiate players. In the other room, anyone that works with seniors, Dr. Zanubli, actually coined the term boomeritis. He's the master on...
Good morning, everybody. Sorry for the technical problems that we have, but we're not pretty good with computers, at least I'm not. I'm very pleased to introduce Jonathan Flynn. Jonathan is a CTPS member at ITPA, and he also has a certification, the CSES certification, for who knows, it's a very difficult certification. He's currently the strength and conditioning coach for the men's and women's teams at Lipscomb University, and he's also the manager and director of health and fitness at Lipscomb Racquet Club. He has a master's degree in exercise and nutrition science. And on top of that, all those achievements, he's found the time to serve our country in the U.S. Army. So please, let's welcome Jonathan.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I don't think we have the mic working yet still, so we're going to get that up soon. Thank you again for everybody coming. I know this is hard for strength and conditioning coaches and tennis coaches and professionals to get away for a weekend and come and listen to this great conference. I came to this conference last year. It was my first time ever here, and I loved it. I learned so much about it that I actually went and got my certification in the tennis performance specialist after I learned from this conference. I want to introduce you to the Lipscomb University tennis teams. I do the strength and conditioning for the men and women, and I travel with the women's team when we go on for tournaments in the fall and for all our matches in the spring. First thing I want to do, I want to say thank you. I've always learned I got to say thank you to everybody who's helped me along the way, because I couldn't be here today without the help of these people. The ITPA for allowing me to present this information to you today. Lipscomb University for employing me and giving me the opportunity to work with such great athletes. John Huddy, who is the director of strength conditioning at Lipscomb. He is a big mentor of mine. He's the one that gave me my first initial internship with Lipscomb, and I want to say thank you to him. The tennis coaches that I work with on a daily basis, Jamie A., Mario Hernandez, and Lynn Griffith. Lynn Griffith helps me. I don't have that big of a tennis background, so he's been one of my mentors to help me get my foot in the door and learning the game of tennis. And then Mario Hernandez, the men's coach at Lipscomb. And then I wouldn't be here today. I wouldn't have my job if it wasn't for JBA to keep me around in tennis. And you'll hear about a little bit about that here in a little bit. And then my wife. Again, I wouldn't have been able to do school, do my military, learn about the game of tennis, and just spend all that time if I didn't have my wife's support, who helped me through grad school when I just went to school and I just learned how to coach and do strength and conditioning while she worked and supported my family. So I couldn't do anything without her. My background, as you guys were told, I did 8 years in the military. My tennis background consists of about 3 months of JV tennis in high school when I was a sophomore. That is my tennis playing background. I didn't play tennis growing up. I was a distance runner. I did endurance running. I played soccer. Those were my kind of sports. I went to the University of Buffalo for 2 years, and school wasn't my niche. I wasn't ready to go to school yet. I wasn't mature enough, I don't think. So what did I do? I joined the Army, and that matured me real quick. While I was in basic training, they had these things called Ranger contracts. They were throwing them around. They had five to give away to the top five PT performers in basic training, and I was like, hey, I'll do that. That sounds hard. I'll do it. I always wanted to challenge myself, and I won one of those. I don't know if I won, but a lot of people think that I was crazy for doing it. anyways, I went through my basic training, airborne school, ranger selection assessment program, and spent 6.5 years working with the ranger regiment stationed in Savannah, Georgia, and Columbus, Georgia. My last 2 years in the Army is when I really started getting into the fitness. I saw the benefits of strength and conditioning that I had on my soldiers that I trained, that I worked with every day, and how we had to carry heavy loads, go long distances, didn't know how long we'd be out there. The strength and conditioning helped. So I started really falling in love with strength and conditioning training. My last 2 years in the Army, I was in charge of all the strength and conditioning to prepare privates, 18 to 20-year-olds, to come through our selection and assessment course, an 8-week vigorous training. I was in charge. I have them from anywhere from 1 month up to 6 months of training them, preparing them to get ready for the assessment program. They told me I either needed to get out of the Army or get promoted because my job was done doing that for training those soldiers. In the Army, you have to get promoted. You got to keep moving on and make room for the next people to come behind you. So I was in love with strength and conditioning so much, I decided to end my time in the Army after 8 years of serving and go and get my master's in exercise and nutrition and become a strength and conditioning coach. So that's when my wife and I, in 2012, at the end of in October, moved to Nashville, Tennessee, and I started working with Lipscomb University as just a volunteer assistant in the weight room in 2013, where I started my master's program there. At the time in 2013, that spring was the last year the current strength coach that worked with the tennis team, that was her last semester there. So she stopped working with them. And Coach Huddy said, I did such a good job, he asked me if I wanted to take over the tennis program. And I said, yes. After that, I got every book and every article that I could possibly find on tennis and learning how to play the game of tennis, learning how to do the fitness component of tennis, because I didn't have that background. I never played. Jamie Aide saw how great I was doing with that and how I was helping the girls team out when she was an assistant at the time, that she asked me to start coming more and more to practice, coming more and more, hey, come on a road trip, come with us on our trip to Florida when we play our Florida team. And I started building that bond and that trust with the tennis coaches then. Throughout the 2013, worked with the teams all nonstop. That was the only team, fortunately for me, I was in grad school still, so that was the only team that I had. I only had to work with those. I know how strength coaches have multiple teams sometimes, and it's hard. Luckily, I've only had to work with tennis. In the winter of 2014, I got my certification in tennis performance specialist here through the ITPA, and I've nonstop loved every minute of it so far. Why am I doing this? I think you always need to have a why. You have to always have a why, what you do, why it's important. I'm doing this because over the last couple of years working with the Lipscomb tennis team, I've noticed, I've talked to other coaches that we've played, a lot of mid-major programs especially, and there is no structured fitness program, strength and conditioning program that a tennis team has. They were doing what our team was doing, just going in the gym. The coach was honestly just doing about five minutes prior, she would set up the workout 5 minutes prior before the team even got there. There was no structured plan. All strength conditioning coaches that has been certified through the NSCA learns about periodization and how you have to have a structured plan to grow your athlete and athletic development. So I want to bridge that gap. I think there is a huge gap between collegiate tennis players and the strength conditioning in the weight room, and I want to bridge that gap. I want to make it better. So that's why I'm doing this presentation. If anything, please, head coaches here of college team, go back, talk to your strength coach, get with your strength conditioning team, and set up a plan, because they know how to do it, and they want to do it. I just want to bridge that gap, I hope. Slide. Table contents, what we're going to talk about, I got the history of Lipscomb tennis. It's not that big, so that won't take long. And then I got two case studies. I'm going to show some quick team results, and then periodization, how I start and how I do my plan. So, Lipscomb tennis, they turned Division I. We were NAIA before 2001. Turned NAIA Division I in 2001, joined the Atlantic Sun Conference. From there, there's been multiple teams in and out of the Atlantic Sun. But that's the conference we started in, and that's what we're in today. Not that great of a history of winning. They're not that strong. They weren't that strong. We're growing it, hopefully, but it just wasn't that strong. There was a couple years. The men's team has never had a winning season, and the women's team, just up until the last 2 years, was the first time that a tennis program actually had winning seasons under them. There was actually 2 years during this time period from 2001 till now that the women's team didn't win a single match. So we're a growing program. It takes time. We're building a culture, changing the system, hopefully, and we see there's a light at the end of the tunnel. Our goal is to be that nationally ranked program behind Vanderbilt in Nashville. So that is our goal. Case studies. On the left here is Jenny Bork. She's a recent graduate. We're going to talk about her for a minute. And then on the right here is Robert Mitchell. He's going to be a junior coming back this fall. Slide. Jenny, she just graduated. She was one of our seniors. She graduated as the all-time winningest Lipscomb tennis player in the history, men or women. I had her for 2 years. I started training with her when she was a junior. That's basically when I really took over the strength conditioning portion of the training. And, you know, she was a great athlete. She was very, very energetic. She was different, but she was a good girl. She started, her starting weight was 115. Her finishing weight was 113, so she stayed around the same. She's 5'6", and then there's her body fat, her body composition, 19.2, and left in April. I did her body fat one more time just before, because I know as soon as the presentation, I wanted to get a quick data, so it's 18.4. Next. Test scores. I test and I use my data. I love to test. I want to see if they're improving, becoming better athletes. Now, if you test just to test and you don't actually use the data, I say don't even worry about testing, but I actually apply their testing, so I think it's very important to get testing scores and throughout the year. When I took over her beginning Virginia year, her endurance, I do the mile and a half test. I don't just do the mile, because there's a mental aspect to running another half mile for them, and I like that. Plus, the mile and a half has a lot of evidence and research backing its correlation to VO2 max. Typical tennis players want to have that average VO2 max around 50, so that's why I use a mile and a half to test their endurance. I test their power endurance. It's a 300-yard shuttle. I do it a little different than the way the NSCA says to do it. I do it the way we did it in the Ranger Regiment. We set up 25 meters on the tennis court. Down and back is one. They do six of those. I only give them 1 minute rest in between, not full recovery. I do that because in a tennis match, you don't sometimes get full recovery. You got to go, you got to go, you got to go. Plus, it really does check their endurance portion. And then I take the two times and I average it together, and that's what her score was, 73. Tennis specific movement, I do the T-test on the court. Her time was 12.54. For power, I do the vertical jump. Not a bad vertical for a tennis player, 16.5. And then strength. So at Lipscomb, we have a board in our weight room where we do pound for pound, who's the strongest athlete for each sport. And for Jenny, and these are the three things that we measure: clean, front squat, and bench. You can tell Jenny's scores when I took over. She did 35 kilos on the clean, 115 was her front squat, and her bench was 85 when I started with her. At the end of her senior year, I test the endurance portion in the fall. I only do the mile and a half run in the fall, because when it comes to springtime, mile and a half really isn't correlation to helping them play tennis. We're working on a different part. We're working on power endurance, so I don't really test the endurance in the spring. But in the fall, she left. She's running 10:33 now. Her power endurance, I'll test this throughout the year, 67.5 when she left. Her T-test was 11.12, her vertical 17.25, and then her strength really went up. I think a lot of it is because she never did a lot of these lifts until I came around, and just learning the lifts and learning the techniques, she was able to get stronger, which I hope correlated in her becoming a better athlete, better tennis player. She did 50 kilos on the clean, and her front squat was 155, and her bench was 95. So here's what I was talking about, the pound for pound. I really want the athletes to be able to believe in the pound for pound strongest athlete. That's the board that we go for and lift them. They have the overall strength ones, and that can be altered by how big an athlete is when they come in and how much lifting they've been able to do in their past. But pound for pound is a good way to see how strong your athlete really is. Her starting her pound for pound, so what we do is we add up these and we divide them by their weight, and hers was 2.54 when she started with me after she learned to clean. And then her senior year, she jumped it up to 3.164. She left Lipscomb as pound for pound the strongest female tennis player that Lipscomb's had. Just from that improvement. She started and she could barely, you could see her there, she couldn't even squat her own body weight. And now she's squatting over her body weight. So that was a big improvement for her for 2 years. The next case study is Rob Mitchell. I got him as a freshman, so that was great. So I'll have 4 years of data on Rob, and it's going to be great for me because I'll be able to see him progress, hopefully, over the 4 years. He's coming in as a junior this year. He's our number one on the men's side. Jenny played around five and six for us throughout the years. Rob's starting weight was 171, and he was 6'1". He was skin and bones. I mean, talk about a skinny guy. And which that's the way tennis players are. We just talked about it yesterday. They're not really big anymore. They're getting lean. They're getting strong that way. But Rob weighed 171, and then in the spring this past year, he weighed 185 now. You can see his body comp dropped a little bit from 8.2 as a freshman to 5.3 now. And here's Rob's scores when he came in as a freshman. His endurance, he is one of those athletes that hates endurance training. He barely did it. I mean, he ran a 12:14 and threw up afterwards. He was not prepared for that kind of test. Rob can move well on the court, but his endurance is, I think, his limiting factor. That's what we've been working on with him. Power endurance, not bad. For men, I have a lot of stats for men, especially being in the Army. The unit I was in was an all-male unit, so we knew our scores. We want to get our scores under 60. We want that average, that power endurance under 60. So that's what I hold for the guys. For the women, I'm trying to figure that out.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
300, is that your standard 25 down and back?
Yes, it's the standard 25 down and back. For the women, I'm trying to get it around 65. So right now, I think I have some women that are getting close to that number, so I'm thinking 65 is a good score right now. Again, I've only been doing it for 2 years with women. So for the men, though, 60 is our standard. We want to be under 60 for that average. There, his tee time, 9.5. NSCA has tennis players right around a 9.4 for men is a good score, and a 10.8 for women is a good score for those. Power, the vertical jump, 21.5, not bad. He's got pretty good vertical. And then his clean, so I wrote here for his clean, start of spring of 2014, because he had to learn the progression. He didn't know what a clean was when he came into me. So I had to start him with a progression, which starts with deadlift and working on strength coaches know how to build up that clean progression. His front squat was okay, 205, and his bench, 145. And then here's his scores currently when he left me this past April. You know, his run time's gotten better. His power endurance, his training yard shuttle's under that 60, so I was happy with that. His tee time down. His vertical stayed about the same, and you can see the strength gain significantly from not doing any strength training for just 2 years now. All right, next slide. And then here's his pound for pound. You know, again, Rob is also currently our pound for pound, our strongest tennis athlete that we have, that Lipscomb's ever had in the 15 years that we've been Division I. Here's some score, just results for the general women's team on what I test them on the same test, the bench, the front squat, the clean, the shuttle, T-test and vertical. The improvements, you can see the initial initials in yellow and the current is in red. This counts freshmen that just came in the program last year too, so that I did add the freshmen in as well. And then here's the men. The men is a little, not as significant in and change, because a lot of the freshmen that just joined Lipscomb's team came in January, and I couldn't do a lot of work with them because January, they come January 6th, we start classes. January 17th was their first match. You know, we gotta get them ready to play tennis matches that count right away. So their scores weren't as significant. And then here's their run times. The men's time was only from, there was only five of them that I have on that data, because they were the only five that were here for the fall testing. I don't have any of my freshman men on this stat. Slide. All right, where do I begin? Actually, I have the meeting with the coaches scheduled for next week. I wanted to do this conference. We have to get through our summer camp that we run at our club. So starting next week, I sit down with both the men's side and the women's side, and we go over our plan. What do we want to achieve? When do we want to achieve it? And what we're going to do. NCAA rules, you know, in season, 20 hours a week. And out of season, we get 8 hours a week with them. During the in-season time, I work with all the tennis players 40% of that time. I get 8 hours a week doing strength conditioning, the off-court movement drills and the weight room a week with them. When we go to out-of-season time, out of the 8 hours, I get 6 of those 8. So that means 6 hours with me, 8 hours are with their coach doing a private lesson or working on something specifically with their head coach or their assistant coach. So we talk about that. We talk about what we're going to do, when we're going to do it. Peak weeks. I need to know when the coaches want their athletes to peak. Right now, currently at Lipscomb, we peak for one thing in the fall and one thing only. That's our ITA week. And that's only certain individuals who's going to ITAs. And then in the spring, it's our conference season. So Atlantic Sun's down to, I think, 7 teams. We just added New Jersey Institute of Technology. We would have only had 6. But we have 7 teams now. That's only 6 conference matches. Every match counts. It's so important because one team gets left back before the tournament out of the 7. So every match counts. So we need to be peaking during conference season. So I need to know when that's happening. So I talk to the coaches and we get those dates down when we're peaking in the spring. Testing weeks. I also put that down because, again, I like the test. For us at Lipscomb, I test in August, right when they come in, that first week. I test right after Thanksgiving break, right before finals for that fall semester, because I have to stop a week prior to finals because that's a rule. I test in January, that first week, just to make sure they did stuff over that winter break. And then I test, because we have conference starting right after our spring break usually every year, I test over spring break for a couple reasons. One, it eliminates that stress of coming into the weight room during conference because they're already busy. They've already missed enough class. There's a lot of stress going on. And two, since they've been testing so well recently, it's been giving them confidence going into their conference season. Like, hey, I'm doing great in the weight room. I'm getting stronger. I'm getting faster. I'm playing really good tennis. So that's when I do my testing, because typically after our conference tournament, we're not allowed to work with athletes again because it falls right when our finals are starting. But I got this from the CTPS instruction manual, the review for the final. I saw this and I was like, I love it. This is how I plan the year. So I have the matches up there. I have the dates written down. This is the women's last year, just this last season. I talk to the coaches, find out the priorities. And then I do my resistance training and then my movement on the court training down here. And the L stands for low priority, M is medium priority, and H is high priority. And that's how I plan out my structure. So after I have a meeting with coaches, I build one of these for each of the men and women. Fine. Off-season. So this is where it all begins, okay? I really believe champions are built in the off-season. Everybody's heard that before. Champions are built in the off-season. This is when the season ends. Their season for me starts as soon as they're done with their conference, with their last match of the year. For us, it's been the conference tournament. First 2 weeks, typically I have them do nothing. I don't let them in the weight room. They need to recover because they've been going for 50 weeks plus right now. I need them to take a break. One, Lipscomb's a very academic focused school as well, and they are behind on schoolwork by now. They've missed a lot of school. They've got to study. They got finals coming up. They need to focus on their academics. So I don't let them in the weight room. I need them to take that stress off. I want them to have fun. I want them to relax and I don't want them doing anything in the weight room. I've really gotten the head coaches to buy into this because they see it too. I mean, you can just see the athletes are drained after the season. After that, typically, if they're here, I want them doing stuff with me if they want. Again, this is all optional for them because we're in the off season; they don't have to. But typically, they end up going home, and the majority of our athletes are international, so they're going all over the world back home. But for the next 2 weeks, I want them to begin some kind of activity again. I want it to be fun. I want them to enjoy it. The men love playing soccer. The girls actually love playing volleyball. I just want them doing something active 5 days a week for about an hour. Just get out there fun. If they want to play tennis, great. If they want to go in the weight room, wonderful. But, I mean, I just want them moving again to build that work habit up again. Right. Next slide. The next part of the portion, this is what I sent home with all the athletes, okay? So we have two different blocks. I have the endurance phase and I have the strength phase, what I call them. So they don't freak out on names because they know what I mean by endurance. They know what I mean by strength. I need them building up their work capacity. They got to be ready when they get here in the fall with a great work capacity. They got to be able to go 20 hours a week without getting hurt because the coaches aren't going to back down. Okay, so they need to be ready for that work capacity. 6 days a week, I want them working, and one day off, I usually give them. Sorry. It's what I built for. So the weight room focus is the circuit training focus. This is what the old coach before I took over was doing with them all the time. Circuit training is good. I think there's a point in it. There's a great time for it. But it's in the off season. It's building that work capacity. It's building that endurance up again. So this is kind of what I do with them, what I send home with them. They have the primary lifts. I like them squatting, doing deadlifts, doing presses, pushes, and pulls. Those are their primaries. And then supplemental lifts, single leg squats. I'm really big. This last year, I added single leg squats to their movement, and I think it's helped. And I'm really liking the development of single leg squats. So I always have a progression of single leg squats I send home with them as well. And then shoulder rotational lifts. I want them doing dumbbell work with their shoulders. Get those movement back, working on those efficiencies with their shoulders. They also love core. So I always throw some kind of crunches. They always want to do like some kind of crunches with a weight where they put it over their feet. I don't know. They have all these weird core exercises that they like to do. So I let them have some kind of say in what they're doing. As long as it's not going to hurt them, I incorporate it so they feel like they're part of the process, which they should be. You want them to want to be in the gym. So I add some core into it. And then phase one of their plyometrics. I want them skipping, hopping, jumping rope. Very basic plyometrics. Yes.
Is that the order that they do the like workout in?
The plyometrics will be part of their warm-up. That the skip, hop, and jump rope was part of their warm-up. I focus on the primary. Yeah, so they'll do the primary lifts first, and then the supplemental, and then the core at the end, yes. But the plyometrics will be at the top. For conditioning, I want them playing tennis again. It's been hard to transition the thought of they want to play really good when they go home, especially the international students. They want to play in the big tournaments in the summer. Well, if they're playing college tennis, we want them peaking in the spring, not the summer, per se. So they're buying into the program now. They're understanding it because I've shown it to them. And hey, I don't want you to continue what we've done all spring into the summer as well now. We need that rest and recovery. So I want them playing tennis. This is when they start playing tennis again. I encourage, 4 to 5 days a week, at least 60 minutes. Again, building that work capacity up. Easy running. This is the only time I prescribe easy running. I know tennis is starting to push away from the easy running, which I agree. You don't easy run on the tennis court, so you need to move like a tennis player on the tennis court. But I believe for the endurance phase, they need to have that work capacity. This is the only time. And some of the female athletes especially like to go for those easy runs. So I set up a little progression starting at 30 minutes, and I work up to 60 or 75 minutes depending on the athlete. Slide. Okay. So the next one here is the weight room. For the next set, it's the strength phase. Again, the standards are just like periodization, how to build strength in the in your athlete. For the conditioning, start playing matches, start playing a little bit more tennis, and then interval running. they start doing some interval running, getting tennis specific movement. I start with 2 times 5 minutes, and I work my way down to 20 to 30 times 30 seconds or 10 times 100 meters to start getting those type 2 muscle fibers start engaging now. Again, this is all about getting that work ethic back, or work capacity back before they get here. Slide. All right, when they come back in the fall, this is what I do in the fall. Testing, again, I need to test them and do a needs analysis. And then I build different programs for incoming athletes opposed to returning athletes. Incoming, get it a little different just because I don't trust what they've done in the past. I don't know their form. I don't know their technique. So their program's a little different. Even transfers fall in this, freshmen and transfers.
Slide.
Preseason, now we're focusing 3 days a week. They're with me in the weight room. 2 days are strength, 1 day is power. This lasts about 5 weeks. We're focusing on training and retraining the form and their strength emphasis. Conditioning, now we're starting to do tennis-specific conditioning. We do one long session a week, example of double plyne to double plyne, or we'll go to the track and do a track workout. I do a short movement session, a modified to the long day, so if we do double plyne to double plyne, I'll kind of cut that workout in half. And then I do one footwork session a week with them, like shadow drills. After ITAs. So that leads up with ITAs. After ITAs, we change. Now I'm focusing more on power. We're starting to get to that power phase. We do 2 power days, 1 strength day a week for about 5 weeks. Teaching that triple extension, that's what we're going to start focusing on. I do start doing more plyometrics, and I test after Thanksgiving. Conditioning, 3 days a week, 2 long sessions, 1 footwork session, because at Lipscomb, we don't have indoor courts, so their play time, they can't play as much tennis anymore, so now I'm doing 2 long sessions inside with them and 1 footwork session instead, because they're not playing as much tennis. So. All right, then they go home, they come back. We have 2 different phases here. It's pre-competition and competition. January through February, it's a power endurance phase, 3 days a week again with me. And now we're doing everything inside. Lipscomb, we have to use private racket clubs for indoor courts. So all their strength conditioning has to happen with me on campus before they go to the court. We don't have time. We only get 2 hours of practice to do their condition for tennis. So all the time they do on the courts is just tennis specific. And then competition is March to the end of the season. It's the maintenance phase where we're maintaining what we've gained. Here's an example of what the pre-competition looks like. This is what I'm doing for power endurance. That's what it looks like in the weight room. And the main thing I'm talking about is explosive. And you guys can see right there the rest intervals. It's designed to be like a tennis match. We try to, every set and every rest interval is designed to what they're going to be doing in a match. So. And then competition, this is what I'm working on. I want to hold 10% of their max strength. That's my goal, is to keep 10% of that strength. Power, 50%. Power endurance, 30%. And muscular endurance, 10%. And recovery is a huge, huge part of the season. We do a lot of recovery drills and extra. That's our focus, to make sure they're feeling fresh to play tennis. After the season, I always do this. I evaluate the program, see what I need to do better. I ask questions that I come across throughout the season. I'm always writing things down so I can make myself better. Slide. And then finally, what I'm going to change this year, I'm going to work on my conditioning drills. I want to do some better. I think I can do better with them, especially the footwork drills. The way I look at volume, I was at the NSCA conference. There was a great presentation about counting reps as opposed to actual the weight that they're lifting. And I want to incorporate the high performance profile evaluation, which I'm excited about tomorrow, of that presentation that we're going to have. Questions? I'm sorry I had to rush through that a little bit with technical difficulties with the computer. I had to go through that part fast. Yes.
I understand the theory of peaking in the spring, mm-hmm. but tennis is very unique where you play all year round. And we have good important tournaments in the fall. Mm-hmm. If you're a professional player, you need to peak 10 months a year. So what would you do for that to happen?
So at Lipscomb, we haven't had those players where we need to peak in the fall, really. We're building to that. Hopefully that program will get to that stage. Right now, the peaking is coming from the head coaches. They want to peak. Their focus is that conference time. If I was training an athlete who is peaking for summer tournaments or fall tournaments, obviously I would plan that into their schedule, and it would be more individualized for that athlete. But Lipscomb hasn't really had a player go deep, as in gone past the second round in ITAs. So that's what we're working towards. We just haven't had that yet. Does that help at all? I have never had to really work with an athlete yet to do that. But I would plan it. I would go and talk to the coaches and find out, and talk to the athlete as well. When do we want to peak? Okay.
If you have any questions, he's going to be around during lunch or later on.